Boris, a Simcar 24. I want to begin by talking about a little bit of history. It's something called AntennaGate occurred, where Apple rolled out the iPhone 4, and there was a reasonably well-publicized issue of the way you held the phone caused issues with reception. And I remember there was discussion after that about hiring people with industry experience or certain vertical experience versus hiring the smartest people and letting them learn. And given our car topics, I was thinking about this as I see leaks or bloggers talk about different people Apple hires for their car plans. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like they've been hiring some industry people. And is that a good thing? You know, should you hire people who companies that maybe a lot of iPhone owners might not buy a car from?
Right. Well, you know, what I would think
a loaded questioner.
Right. Generally, the rule is that you want to have open minds, and it's easier to get an open mind when it hasn't been filled already.
Right.
And that seems to work as a metaphor. The other way to think of it is that if you hire industry people, you hope that they're people who have the ability to also relearn and unlearn. And that's the you know, there shouldn't be a discrimination on the basis of your being experienced. That isn't probably workable. I'm reminded of an episode in the history of Ford, which was the transition from the Model T to the Model A. And this is a legendary transition. Yeah. If you haven't read about this, it's fascinating. I'm getting it from, I've gotten twice, once from the book Freedom's Forge, which is actually about World War II.
World War II, right.
But the other one was just recently, I was reading the book called The American System of Manufacture from, in the antebellum to World War II. And this is the period and this is much more scholarly work. I think the author is a professor. And someone actually on my feed when I mentioned this book said, oh, that professor taught me so much. So the person is actually still active, I think. But the book was written sometime in the 90s. And it tells the very crucial story of manufacturing pre-World War II, because mostly we think about the post-war miracle of the American economy, but actually manufacturing that led to the boom and indeed the potential of production that occurred during World War II, which actually led to the winning of the war. All those methods, systems, learnings, processes, priorities were formed in between 1865 and 1935, arguably. And this is when American manufacturing as a distinct form of manufacturing emerged as a force on its own. And it isn't recognized as far as I know. I mean, when I read the book, much of it was new to me. And I like to think that I'm reasonably well informed on business history. So everybody knows the Whitney patented machinery and the first interchangeable part product, which was the gun. It was a firearms manufacturing was the first adopter of interchangeability as a condition, as a demand, as a requirement. And then we had machines that were adopted for harvesting cotton, the cotton gin. And then later, I think one of the first consumer product successes was the sewing machine from Singer. And the book gets into all of these. It gets into the American system for manufacturing weapons. And by the way, the reason it was called the American system was because it was in contrast to the European system. And the American system of manufacturing is what we think of today as mass manufacturing sometimes, assembly line manufacturing, but more importantly, interchangeable parts, because the European system was craft-based, and therefore the assumption was that the product would be the result of a workman doing the job on it. And so it was a one person, one product kind of mapping. And that meant that there was final rework on the product to make it fit and finish that was of the highest quality. And so to this day, you know, I think the European, the perception is Europeans would work on things differently in that sense of craftsmanship. And so the Americans were less craft oriented. And so it didn't matter if the final product was touched by one man, it mattered that it just worked and that the parts were interchangeable. So one thing about the European system is that each part would have a serial number. And so you would want to have when you buy something secondhand, you want to check that the parts match. That was one of the things that Americans slowly throughout the 19th century did away with. Anyway, this is a very long story. I'm off on very, very
the weeds. Although that's still, as you know, as a Porsche owner, the German car manufacturers have many variants. And when looking for parts, sometimes you can still get into these issues where, well, we made that for 18 months and therefore that part is no longer available. And anyway, but yes,
there may be some legacy to that still. I don't know. But the point is that, so what happened with the Model T and the Model 8? And this is late in the book, right? Because it happened in the 20s. And a Model T production caused Ford to explode. I mean, it was generally like explode in a good way. I mean, it grew like crazy and became a Goliath. And General Motors, which actually really was a conglomerate or an assembly of brands, was unable to keep up. In fact, the reason that GM was formed was because these companies were all getting crushed by Ford, and they thought they might survive.
Right.
Yeah, it might survive together.
Right.
And Knudsen, who was actually the guy who worked at Ford on their production system, eventually moved to Chevrolet and worked on their system and actually improved it. And at Chevrolet, he promised that he would go to match, you know, in production Ford. So they would go essentially 50% market share with Ford. And that was incredible at the time to make that claim, because Ford was so far ahead, but eventually they did.
Sure, Ford stagnated.
And so because of the innovations in production methods that were much more flexible and model year changes were possible, so flexible manufacturing was coming on stream for Chevrolet, then Ford was caught in the innovator's dilemma. They had the Model T on the basis of performance, which was manufacturability and output. They were exceeding the demands of the market. They were more streamlined than they needed to be. What they needed to do was do model year changes, which means that actually scale down on the number of units of production, because again, what mattered more is variety and flexibility,
perceived value. Yeah.
Right. So you don't need to sell 8 million of the same car, of the same color, of the same configuration every year. That no longer is what the market wants. At a time when there were no cars, that made a lot of sense. But at the time when people had cars, they wanted different new cars. So they had already in the 1920s, the basis of competition for manufacturing cars shifted towards a more flexible model, which is what Chevrolet had.
Right.
And Ford didn't. And so in order to switch from Model T to Model A, which was going to be their next product, Ford had to shut down its plant and actually completely reconfigure it.
Right.
And that was sort of so traumatic. It took months. It took years of planning, months of execution, and months of recovery once the shutdown was reversed or was restarted. And what Ford, what the book talks a lot about is some of the drama around the people. It was almost as if, it reads almost like a gangster story.
There certainly were elements of that in Detroit at the time. Yes.
Yeah, but it really the guys who had built the Ford system were fired almost one by one, and by Ford himself. And he had a scorched earth policy as far as getting rid of every Model T man. That was the way they wanted to change, because he, I mean, why not do it, you know, comfortably? Why not do it gently? Why not? It turned out that those political problems that we experienced with an incumbent that finds it difficult to change, they were felt so deeply at the organization that literally Ford had to go in and quote unquote assassinate all these people.
Yes. Yes.
It was a story about a guy that they wanted him gone. But the way they executed his firing is that he was driving on some road in on vacation. He was told, take a couple of weeks off. He's driving on a road in Michigan, and a policeman pulls him over. And then he's like, yeah, how can I help you, officer? And, see, and you know, the officer said, are you so-and-so? And he said, yeah, I got a message for you. You're fired.
You're fired.
He actually, you know, Ford called ahead on this guy's planned route and told the policeman to pull him over and tell him he's fired, because somehow that was the only way to get it done. And there were so many of these stories about these loyal, very smart
company men, Horace.
Company men. who were quote unquote assassinated,
yes.
and many of them, I'm sure, went on to build other careers in automotive. You know, I'm sure they were around for decades after. But still, the point is that it was so traumatic that they went around doing drastic heads must roll policies in order just to bring a new model into the market.
Right.
Yeah. And so here's that. What's the moral of this story? Is that. Even if you're, in this case, you're shifting slightly in your strategy, the people who are there who built the previous strategy are going to have a hard time letting go.
Yes.
And what, you know, if you're an entrant, as the case may be with Apple, then the question is this: do you go and poach the Ford man? Do you poach the man who built the previous generation of technology, the Model T guys, or do you just train new people to solve it? And I think that's your question.
That is the question, right? So here we are; they're hiring these people. What does that tell us, Horace?
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, it's going to come down to that interview process and who makes that hiring decision and who's the hiring manager, and they're going to go through and ask these people, you know, how would you handle a situation? And the if you say, well, we got this figured out back at GM, we figured this out, we're going to build it this way, then, you know, that may not be the right approach. If you've got to test on their ability to take the best of the old, but also replace what needs replacing. And I'm just saying there's no simple formula. I haven't even thought of, you know, how to even do that. But what I would say is as far as the problem at hand, let's step get back, wade back in, you know, take off our socks and just wade in.
The water's warm, Horace. Yes,
the water's warm.
We'll talk about that later too.
Yeah, because if you think about what Tesla did, and Tesla had to make the same decisions.
Yes.
Do you hire people from Detroit or
Japan,
Stuttgart,
or wherever, right.
or Yokohama,
right.
And you hire them to build Teslas, or do you say, let's just read the book and come at it with a fresh point of view,
begin anew.
Yeah. It's a hybrid. I watched a very interesting video we should link to. It's one of the co-founders of Tesla talked for an hour about how the company started, and I had never seen this video, and it was only a few thousand people have seen it. I mean, from the view count on this thing, it was an obscure event.
Yeah.
It looked like, you know, in an ad hoc environment, not a fancy auditorium with a small audience of probably entrepreneurs, And he talks about their trouble with transmissions, among many other things. And so when they were building their first, the Roadster, that the transmission they had decided upon was a two-speed transmission. And when they went to, they were going to buy it, not build it. And when they went to buy a transmission, they failed in testing. And they determined later that actually nobody builds new transmissions anymore, meaning that
this is true.
there was a transmission that was invented, an automatic transmission, for example, would have been invented. The power glide or whatever it was called. Each company
hydromatic,
hydromatic. Fine, exactly. Each company, like Chrysler, had its own, and Ford and GM would have their own, and they would brand them that way, right? Some kind of hydroglide and fluid power, whatever. And so they put those inventions from the 50s have been tweaked and tweaked and tweaked, but no engineer is employed today who can build a completely new transmission. And apparently that skill set is gone. I mean, maybe in Formula One, there's a few people, but those are very, very different transmissions you get for the automotive market. And so they go to a company, and this company delivers a two-speed transmission, but it's a hack job. It doesn't work. It falls apart. Mm-hmm. In testing, they get actually into a lawsuit with these guys because they felt that they didn't deliver on their contract terms. Yeah, and it's some funny bits in there as well. But the thing is that they actually ended up building their own transmission. Right. They had to actually hire people to design, mechanical engineers to design transmissions, and really relearn how to do that.
Exactly my point. And so think about what that meant to the project.
And by the way, to a single speed, they had to actually abandon the two speed because eventually the motor got good enough that they didn't need two speed anymore.
Right.
And so partly that problem was solved for them by the guys who worked out on the transistors that were feeding the motor controller, were able to handle more power. And so actually the motor was able to handle more power.
Yeah, and you have software to manage it all. And
the irony of it is that actually what saved their ass was improvements in semiconductors, not mechanical engineers. Yeah,
and so to me, that is my point. You think about this whole process, right? So Tesla does this. They have a timeline. They have a capital plan. They're a startup sort of. But then this thing happens. Transmission doesn't work. It's that they're betting it. So now they've got to start over. That expands the timeline, raises costs.
Yeah,
most companies, that gets killed, right? I mean, 99% of them, that thing's dead.
The interesting thing, back to the same video, because it opened my, it sort of really reoriented my thinking around Tesla a lot, because looking at that formative period, you actually get to determine why things are the way they are now. But the interesting thing also was just how much they relied on the auto industry to have off-the-shelf parts for them to include in the car. So they used the design talents from Lotus. They used off-the-shelf components of batteries, which were actually commoditized. They were laptop batteries. So the form factor were these, cylindrical small batteries. Was it 1886 or something? 18886, something like that. There's a number for these batteries that you can Google and find them. And in fact, they're used in all kinds of other applications. Turns out when I searched for this battery number, I was getting all these hits on Google for cigarette, these e-cigarettes.
Oh, e-cigs, sure. Vaping.
So e-cigs use the same batteries as Teslas do. Reference there. And I think the e-cig market may be bigger than the Teslas.
I think so.
Consumption of batteries. And they joke and talk about how when they went to Panasonic and explained, Panasonic has imagined a world where every person would have three of their batteries, and they would have them in their laptop, in their phone, or in their camcorder or something like that. And they told them, no, we want 6,000 batteries per person, not six. And they just couldn't get their heads around it. But I'm sure with e-cigarettes, we're going to be looking at whether you have
billions
a Tesla or not.
Right.
But still, the funny thing is how they relied on the industry to just say, well, look, we just have a simple idea of integrating modules. And the modules we need are batteries that are just going to need to scale up. But everything else about the car, we can just pick off the shelf. So their logic was really, let's just leverage leverage modularity. Yep. It turns out, though, that the version one, which did use a Lotus platform, did not actually do a lot about growth because, it established them, allowed them to go public. It allowed them to finance themselves, given that the song and dance VCs need to go through.
Right.
But it really wasn't a disruptive strategy in many ways, because, you know, you're starting at the high end and then you're just you're essentially parlaying each success into another opportunity to raise more money.
It's one business model for us. Yes.
Yeah, that was really their business model. It's like, how do we get to the next round, the next funding event? And there was like, yeah, we need a mule, a test mule. Then we need a production prototype. Then we need an actual product sold. And then you're essentially, as an entrepreneur, in fact, from the look of it, that's when the story ends for them. It ends when they go public and Elon Musk joins the company. As far as they're concerned, they're done, because right. they've started it and it's off and running. And as an entrepreneur, I mean, the guys who founded it were from ebook industry, which is cosmically weird, because I was in the ebook business right around the same time when they were. These guys were. So I knew a long discussion.
Yeah.
And they actually sold the business to TV Guide, which I met the guy who also was acquired by TV Guide, and we chatted quite a bit about what was going on at the time.
It was going to be huge. Yeah.
Anyway, the thing is that the components that they thought would be on the shelf turned out to be not good enough. They ended up redesigning. And one of the things they thought there would be on the shelf would be the manufacturing system. And this is where I think they made a grave mistake. And this is why I'm critical of Tesla. The assumption, and this is, again, it comes out in the video and is contradicted by my post on the sort of the 10 commandments of the auto industry. Their assumption is that the auto industry was modular. Absolutely. It comes through very loud and clear. It says they said, look, even the car guys have outsourced everything. Windshield wipers, tire, car bits, and all that
parts,
stuff.
Everything.
Yes, there is a supply chain that's quite deep and broad, but there is a control around the production system, and there's a control point around the production system, and so therefore everything has to conform to that production system. So their notion of modularity drawn from the computing industry was insufficiently detailed or nuanced about what is it.
What's
really
actually there,
so
right?
Where are the boundaries between modules? What are the interfaces? How do you define them? How many modules? How many business models? Everything else was just modular, just like computers are modular. But it turned out that then they had to build their own production system, which meant that they actually had to essentially rely. They went and bought a car plant. They thought, well, this is copy paste. This is production system, copy paste. Let's get production guys brought over from Detroit. Let's get machining. Now, today they say it's slightly different. They say our production method actually is not like the way Detroit's building it, and which is, we do use robots, we do use sheet metal stampings, we do use welding, but our robots do more than one job. I'm sorry, but that's not sufficiently departing from the logic of auto manufacturing. You need to rethink deeply the production system, and that means move away from sheet metal, move away. And I'm sure they've thought about it, but for whatever reason, and again, because you come in with a set of assumptions and then you try to unlearn them and fix them, and you've gone far enough down the road that now you're in the third model switch. That you're going through, and you're trying to mix two models in the production line at the same time, which indeed is unusual. Mostly, you can make variants of the same model. So Mini, for example, has a production line where they use the same line to make, you know, the hatchback, the convertible, the Mini Clubman, which is a kind of a station wagon design. They can all come through the same line, but you can't make a Mini and a BMW 3 Series on the same production line. And so you, even though it's the same company, even though they probably have the same components.
Toyota's probably the most advanced in that. I mean, they have a factory in Indiana, I believe, where they make minivans and sedans and lots of things. And again, I think your point is spot on, but I want to step back a bit to this larger question. One of the things that the next page from AntennaGate and thinking about when Apple introduced the A7 system on a chip, I remember being quite impressed that they had the management strength, obviously they have the money, but the management strength to pull off a 64-bit volume system on a chip and at the same time ship the software tools for developers to make that happen. Then you think about what's happened. So that was 2013. 2 years later, they've got incredible camera technology. They've got all sorts of things that they've built because of that investment that probably took 5 years, 6 years. I have no idea. But for all that to come together and coalesce at the same time, if you think about the history of computers, often a new hardware, a new chip technology ships, but then there's usually a compatibility layer, and you know it takes years to create the right tools for that process. But they pulled that off. And what I'm getting at when I think about that, and I think about hiring the legacy guys, you know, is that going to preclude them from the big process leaps, right, that you were talking about?
Yeah, you know, that's the thing, and it's a question mark, because a lot of I'm not certain. In other words, I think there's my criticism is tempered by the fact that actually many times the companies that are really well managed recover from flawed assumptions and pivot.
Right.
I mean, Microsoft, for example, thought of the world as PC-centric, which was valid in the 80s, and was caught somewhat flat-footed by the internet,
sure,
but managed to pivot. But that's because the internet was sustaining to their core business. And in the question for Tesla would be, well, if there was a new production system that suddenly did become available, will they actually eventually junk the old and start with the new, even though that's a major change, because they're not GM, because they're well managed and they're unafraid, or because they, you know, they have had a technical background that's computer oriented rather than dyed in the wool production oriented. So that's where there's a possibility that they can recover from that incorrect assumption about modularity. And so I'm not saying that Tesla as a business would fail, or that Tesla as a business may not eventually disrupt, but it isn't disruptive the way it is now. And furthermore, there are other reasons to doubt. We get into this over and over again. If you listen to management, they show no indication of wishing to disrupt, believing that this industry can be disrupted, and so they are very much thinking that winning is exactly what they are doing, which is being a microscopically small manufacturer of cars in a world where there are over 2 billion of them. You know, they're dreaming of making a few hundred thousand a year. Right. Which means that they will never really replace. This is not the Model T story. This is not even the Volkswagen story. This is not even the Toyota story. This is just being another Jaguar or another Porsche, or maybe at an extreme, maybe another BMW. That doesn't change the world so much. And in fact, the way the world would change in their view, in their mind, is that everybody will copy them and do electric cars, and that's winning for them because the world gets better as a result. But I think this is a philosophical debate. I would rather think that you want to be in control of that change rather than exactly hoping that others will copy you.
So we have another example, another approach related, I guess. Just recently, Toyota announced, and again, this amount of money is really inconsequential in their world, but so they've spent $50 million, or they've committed $50 million to a robotics and AI effort in collaboration with Stanford and MIT, and they've hired a guy, Gil Pratt, a roboticist, to run this, right? So to me, there's one of two outcomes here. One, you know, Toyota is a very serious company. They tend to execute extremely well. But perhaps this is, like a lot of the automakers, simply a spending money to try to react and do something. On the other hand, is it do things like this, do these major changes we're talking about, do they require more of a Skunk Works project, which maybe this is an example of that, you know? So what do you think about that?
Yeah, and the scope of commitments, $50 million doesn't even rank.
No, it's tiny. It's but sometimes you can have too much money, as you have.
That's true too, and that's why I'm not sure measuring that is the best way to measure commitment. But I, you know, one thing that I would calibrate against would be the cost of a new manufacturing plant. We brought that up before. It's in the $1 billion range. Good one. $2 billion, meaning good in terms of big. And you know, BMW spending $9 billion on the X series production line in the U.S. is typical over a period of years. That's what it takes to get a model, you know, not of significantly large number. How much did it cost for Ford to retool an existing plant for the F-150 to do aluminum instead of steel? That plant probably required $2 billion again in retooling costs and very, very precarious situation in terms of, you know, that's the stuff that really the industry insiders talk in terms of legends and successes and anecdotes. And $50 million is not great. And again, the great story from the Tesla founders is that when they looked at the commitment level of competitors to electric cars, they remarked how the funding came out of two possible sources. One was the advanced powertrain research, I think, that would fund an electric car rollout. So this would be on the level of, let's say, Fiat 500e, the electric Fiat 500. Or I'm not saying they did it that way, but I'm just saying that a small, you know, tweak of an existing model that would be funded sort of through a powertrain or out of the PR budget. Literally that the PR department would carve out a bit of money to fund an electric car in large manufacturing. That to them is an indication of a failure of commitment. And nevertheless, again, it's important not to read too much into those initial efforts. The industry and even Tesla admits their dream will come true, that everybody will be making electric cars and crush them into oblivion. In parentheses, I would add. This is the question of timing. This is a question of not that the money is more a question of how quickly this will happen. And there are some interesting, there's other interesting anecdotes in terms of understanding the market for electric cars. And one of the things they pointed out was that the earliest adopters of the Prius car, which were in California, were people who were, high end of the market buyers. And yet the Prius was designed as a very low end platform. It was built on top of the cheapest car platform that Toyota had at the time. And the way they observed that this was a high-end phenomenon is that Toyota saw its Lexus sales come down once the Prius was launched in those markets. So they're able to see with precision. So they would see that suddenly, hey, we just introduced the Prius. What's going on? And sales meeting, you know, would happen. And the Prius guy would say, we sold more than we expected. Right. And the Lexus guy would say, what? Because we just had a big dip.
Cash flows down. Yeah, what's the deal?
And it turned out that people were putting in their driveway beside their Porsche a Prius, and it was entirely purchased as a way to signal and indicate, or as a way to, what's the term that's used in church dogma when you pay for your sins?
Sanctification, or
you confess and confess, you take a penalty from the priest, and that's what these people felt like doing. They wanted to make amends for their overconsumption by buying a Prius.
Right.
And so what the implication is that you would be much more successful paying for your sins by buying a Tesla because it's much more expensive. And so
that has not happened with BMW, by the way. I posted something a month or so ago that i3 sales, while tracking the early Prius, they're very similar. Their first 18 months to 2 years, they certainly are promoting many, many deals on the i3. So anyway, it's interesting. Maybe the passage of time, or maybe the i3 is the wrong answer. Who knows?
Indeed, things change. But that was the signal to Tesla. And again, it's spoken through a Tesla mouthpiece. But it's the idea is that the observation was that the incumbents looked at electric cars as being worse on the basis of existing definition of performance. And so hybrids and electrics would be thought of as cars that save people money, and therefore we're going to position them very, very low. Whereas Tesla said, no, the real market is people paying for their sins. And those guys will be willing to pay a lot because they sinned a lot. And so sell them $200,000-$300,000 cars, and tears will flow from their eyes and thanks for you giving them a much more expensive option to which to prove their atonement.
So to pull these things off, Skunk Works, or as Henry Ford did, fire the source of antibodies and charge ahead as long as you have the leader. What's the recipe for?
Yeah, so a lot of storytelling here, but the fact is, so what does Apple do? Does Google do? I mean, the here again we may have failures of marketing potentially. And let me describe it this way. And I touched on this in Critical Path a little bit, but we see the first instance of a Google car being this cute little bug, not to be confused with the Volkswagen bug, which is actually genuinely
more attractive.
More attractive. Yes. But the idea of this cute little car that gets you around, and it's a pod. It's a little,
it's just a pod.
A human pod. And hipsters will ride these streets of San Francisco and so on. But in fact, that there's a market. There's certainly a market out there for people. The way Google presents the need for autonomy is, I love this too. I saw a Tesla talk from a Google self-driving expert or manager or whatever authority on that, and he said that look, car advertisements show people having fun in convertibles, wind in their hair, beautiful vistas in the background, vroom vroom, zoom zoom,
Provence, of course, yeah.
And he said this is reality, and then it cuts to a shot of photo of a dark, congested commute in the rain, and the person driving is looking at their smartphone,
right?
And saying, look, this is a person stuck in traffic. This is what car driving is really all about. And I'm sure you can add a lot of hours stuck in traffic as the experience of car driving. And as a result, their statement is people don't want to drive. They don't like driving. Driving is not fun. You're trying to sell them on the notion of pleasure, but in fact,
it's not
driving
the case.
Is pain. Driving is not pleasure. Driving is pain. We're going to remove the pain. Now, and that, pause for a moment and think about that. And then car guys, car companies, and do sell the dream of freedom.
Sure, the open road, the convertible.
Open road. And that is still aspirational in many parts of the world. But isn't that what Tesla is also selling? So let's not compare Ford against the baddies in Detroit, or Tesla against the baddies in Detroit. But what about Tesla versus Google? Here's Tesla arguing that actually we're going to make a car that is designed to pay for your sins, but to make it a little bit more easy to swallow, we're going to make it a high performance car. In fact, that's how we're going to sell it. And so you're repentant.
Feel good, but you feel good quickly.
Yeah, repentance is actually still pretty much fun. So you go to jail, but it's a pleasant garden atmosphere. Right. The thing is that the Tesla is just going into these insane performance figures, which are clearly overserving, and that's one of the reasons people always say, buy a Tesla. And those who have it say it's the best car in the world and all this and that. So they're not, none of them are saying that it avoids or removes the pain of my driving experience. And so, again, would Google launch, if they were to launch a product that is essentially an antidote to the pain of cars, then they're addressing, again, a customer segment, just like Toyota addressed with the Prius a customer segment. And Toyota addressed it saying that this is a car to save you money to customers who are insensitive to that question. And here, Google might be addressing, here's a car to save you the grief of driving to people who have money, the early adopters, presumably, who are going to look at it and say, but where is the Porsche-like handling? So, you know, why don't... So maybe the job of the antidote to boring driving is just being on a rocket ship ride or being on a
sure, you know, the on-ramp is fun, but then everything else.
What if the experience of sitting in another car? Yes, you might be there and not like sitting on, but it's more like sitting on a bus. Yes, you'll be alone, but you'll still be sitting on the bus, and the bus is slow. And the bus is frustrating because it seems not to move very quickly, even if it's going with the flow. But there's a lot of questions about what the experience will be like. Many people say, yes, it's just fine. The way, you know, sitting in a driverless car is pleasant enough. But I think people after some time might change their mind because, again, there's this question about the job to be done being having fun, not just being dulled into a sense of, you know, let me turn on my Android experience. So let me go into this other theory I have, which is that there are the segmentation that we're hearing. There are several, obviously. We're hearing about cost. We're hearing about pleasure. We're hearing about performance. As ways of segmenting and sort of deciding, these ultimately are deciding what the job's to be done. Is it brutally just going from A to B as cheaply as possible, or is it more about going to you know, having a joyride? The alternative. I'm sorry, I'm hearing a lot of noises. The alternative would be to think about also what I called the joy of ownership, which is the idea that you may have an object that you're proud of, an object that you feel every day you look at it, it's like you feel a little bit of a thrill. And that's the thing about a lot of car owners, I think, have that job to hire for, to have a little thrill and pride of ownership. And that, I think, is the number one job in emerging markets. It's number one job for early car owners. And, you know, it isn't transportation. It is a point of pleasure and pride. And therefore, you need to give an object that has visual qualities.
So you're saying the ownership, the aesthetic.
The aesthetics are extremely important.
And still a thing.
It is huge, I think, because when you see the most successful new brands, like we talked in the past, Mini, Fiat 500, although these are small volume. Well, they add up together because in Europe especially, and in mature markets, you have cars that are appealing not just to nostalgia, but to a sense of style, to a sense of, I mean, this is, I would say, it shifts more skews towards a female demographic because they've been ignored by the auto industry. And so the auto industry has been pushing.
Oh, yeah. I know a number of women who have Range Rovers. Yeah. I mean, you're right about that. But I guess in terms of the next 10 years, let's say, you know, I'll bring up another topic related to this that's near and dear to your heart, and that's professional sports. I was driving with my daughter and some of her college classmates to a Packer game recently, a Green Bay Packer game. And of course, A, none of them wanted to drive, but B, one of them brought up Tesla. And I said, how do you know about this? And so her father apparently reads Consumer Reports and said that they had received this, you know, great rating in Consumer Reports, you know, whatever. But it was curious to me that A, these are all licensed drivers. They're just getting ready to graduate from college. And B, they all use Uber. And C, not terribly interested in driving. I mean, they do it, but it's not, you know, and maybe in 10 years, maybe they will care about the aesthetics of their car. I don't know. But is everything else, these other things that we in the more, let's say, the first world economies have, these devices?
This is why this is also Tesla hasn't got an answer for emerging markets, is that almost all the growth is happening in these markets now. The number of cars on the road globally will double, even if even if they decline in the U.S. and Europe, because there's just so much non-consumption. And those who when the West mobilized, or the first world, as it used to be called, or shouldn't be called that.
Right.
But the early countries to take to the roads eventually went through certain stages: utilitarian, then aspirational, then power and performance, then nostalgia, right? So we see these phases coming through, and then we see potentially at the end simply getting to a stage where people are just thinking of them as utilitarian again and somewhat boring, and let's move on.
Yes.
But even within those segments, you still see a hardcore of enthusiasm. Let me also put it to you this way. I mean, let's talk about my favorite TV program, Top Gear. So how did Top Gear end up being the most popular program in the world, a motoring show, as they call it, become the most popular TV program in the world? And not only are they continuing with it without Clarkson and company, but Clarkson and company just got funded for over $250 million to continue doing similar shows for 3 years. That will be the most highly funded TV program in the world.
Yes.
To something like $7 million per production per episode. Plus, that's not including the fees for the talent, which probably would be at least another $7 million per show. So you're dealing with budgets per episode of a TV program that are in the movie scale, right? Let's follow the money here for a minute. Who's paying for it? Amazon. And we talked about how much did Toyota commit to a new robotics program?
$50 million. Nothing.
This is $250 million as a bet that people love cars. And as a bet that by using that love of cars, they're going to buy Amazon Prime. That's the bet.
That's
and,
the bet
and,
yeah.
and once they get into Amazon Prime, they'll buy lots of other things and keep Amazon.
Keep their cash flow positive, maybe.
And keep their executives in Porsches.
Right.
And the thing is, here's the cosmic thing. You've got a technology company betting $250 million on the love of cars through entertainment bets. You've got Google who's saying people don't like to drive. Tesla saying people sure do like to drive, but they also like to pay for their sins. And we don't know what Apple's going to be saying. I'm just hoping that Apple says, you know what? We can't solve this problem globally with one product on day one, so we're going to start with something. And I believe that the thing that makes sense for Apple to start with is, again, something around love. And if it's something around love and the passion and pride, all the things that designers care about and designers can contribute, which is why Apple would join this game, because they have something meaningful to contribute. And I think that Johnny Ive, who's going to be the contributor, it's going to be a product that will be interesting as an object of desire.
Yes.
And by the way, even if the world is going in exactly the opposite direction, it hasn't been unheard of that Apple will take the world back to another direction, because simply introducing a great product will do that. So you'll take a product which is commoditized like a personal computer and put it inside of a beautiful aluminum case, and suddenly it's an object of desire, and the market shifts away from more and more boring to more and more exciting. And so it's possible that just Apple's entry would cause some shift to occur, just like Volkswagen did. But don't forget, Volkswagen was zigging when everybody was zagging. Volkswagen introduced a product in the United States where everybody was going through tail fins.
Big, yes, and big and better, absolutely.
Big V8s and enormous land yachts. And here's, you know, literally the most asymmetric product you could imagine at that time entering and taking off and being really successful. And so that's where I see Apple's entry, even with an electric car, being truly a gorgeous object. I see it being truly an object that people are going to associate with, empathize with, you know, cause them to say the same gooey things they say about other Apple products, that they love it and they become attached to it. And I see it has skewing female. I see it skewing aesthetic. I see it do all those things that we know Apple does. It's not going to be a business model innovation. It'll be a design showcase. It'll be beautiful. It will not be necessarily high performance in the Tesla sense or the Porsche sense. I don't see it as a Ferrari. I see it as a Fiat.
It'll have a small distance capacity
if it's so, yes, that's possibly. Right. But I see more along the lines of something adorable,
right,
than something that says, look at me and my
0 to 60 in 2 seconds, right?
Yes, my phallic symbol. It's not going to be a phallic symbol. It's definitely going to be an object of a bijou, you know, an object of art. So that's where I'm thinking about Apple's entry. That doesn't mean that they wouldn't go there. I don't want to disclaim it too much, but nor does it mean that's where they'll end up. They might actually create a whole range of cars, as every car maker does, because actually car ownership is spread around across multiple
many reasons.
Desires. And by the way, more Ford Model T didn't do that, and it survived as an entry. Volkswagen didn't do that, and it survived as an entrant. And Toyota Corolla didn't do that, and it survived as an entrant. But eventually, they all expanded out of that.
Exactly. So, yeah. So sort of to summarize this good discussion on getting from concept to reality, I guess the first point is, so you're arguing that Tata made a significant mistake by going too generic with their Nano.
The argument I've always made is that in that market, it was an aspirational market. It was also a market filled with used cars that were cheap already, but good enough. So the competition in India, if it was a country with no cars at all, it would have probably been a wildfire success. But in a car which had already quite a few cars, and people could therefore actually have had those cars for a long time, meant that it was a secondary market. Sure. It's very difficult for you to agree to buy a used, a new Nano with bare functionality.
Less capable than your used car.
And it didn't look fantastic. No. It was not designed. It was designed from a requirement of cost.
Right.
And as a result, you ended up with the body that the way it looked.
Looked like it.
If you design from the skin in, so that I think the Apple design would start with the skin, would start and say roughly this is what we want to create in terms of an object.
Yeah.
Then you build, that's the way the design at Apple works, is they don't build to a cost. They build to an idea
vision,
of what the
right.
job may be, right? The language I use is job to be done. So if they say we build to that job, and then we recognize, of course, in the process we'll dip into manufacturing questions and all that stuff. So,
we had the example to close a bit here recently of two things. One was BMW announcing that within 10 years they'll be all electric. Maybe that's obvious, maybe not. But so is. Is that, again, more of a, let's say, a Henry Ford?
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought it up, because I think it's one of these watershed events.
Clearly, Bavarian Motor Works.
Yeah, here you have a performance brand known as the Ultimate Driving Machine that is actually saying, and again, maybe it's consistent with the new market creation process, which is actually new markets are not necessarily created from the low end. New markets are usually created from the high end. People try to call this high-end disruption, but it's not. It's actually new market disruption. So the new market is actually because there's a new job to be done, and Tesla touched on that job and built that business. So what BMW is recognizing is that their customers are actually moving to new jobs. They're moving for performance to sin reduction.
Redemption, whatever, yeah.
Redemption.
Confession, redemption, yes.
And so it could be a bet that they're going to fail on, but I think that's the bet they're making. So they're going to try to preserve some of the performance, but at the same time trying to also be less sinful. And so this is what you end up with a strategy, is sort of saying. Plus, of course, they're being whipped by governments to do this, especially in Germany. And those whippings will continue. And those are generally actually whippings of industry by regulators tends to sustain them. You know,
it keeps the existing game going. Yeah, exactly.
It's almost never the case that a regulator causes disruption through through the promulgation of a regulation. It always sustains. It's done in usually regulations are introduced after lengthy consultation with incumbents. And so incumbents rarely get punished by regulations.
But in BMW's case, so just think about the infrastructure that company has in the traditional supply chain. I mean, they are known for their engines, right? I mean, they're known. They buy their transmissions. Some of them, I don't know if they make any actually, but certainly engines and many parts of the car, they have an incredible supply chain for all of that. So that means at the top level, you're going to essentially jettison, you know, fire some of these people as Henry Ford did when they're on vacation. You know,
yes and no, but don't forget they will continue making the engines. I think these engines, when you say all electric, what they mean is all range extended electric and or hybrid. I think it's the logic is that they'll still have small, very efficient engines.
Motorcycle engines, yeah. Well, they make those, yeah.
Right. Yeah, they'll make those. But sometimes the engineering for those is actually quite challenging. They'll run in a much more narrow range of RPMs because they'll be tuned for efficiency. And so that means that they'll probably just operate as generators more. It's like a diesel electric locomotive. I mean, the diesel in a diesel electric locomotive is not driving the wheels directly. Maybe that's not a perfect match. But in this case, it's a sort of a hybrid drivetrain. Okay, but yes. Fair point. I think the horsepower is going to be probably overwhelmingly delivered by an electric motor, and maybe that's no longer they're going to be their emphasis on motors. But again, motors may have just run their course. I don't know how much more they can squeeze out of that technology. They've just been pulling in every possible direction, going to diesel, going to turbocharging, sure, going to cylinder configurations that are unusual.
Yeah, there are three cylinders right there. But in the closing question I have, so BMW has said this, you know, we have the Apple discussion, we have Tesla, we have Toyota recently. Can those brands transition? In other words, is, as you mentioned, the importance of aesthetics. Can those brands transition to the new experience?
Well, again, to me, this is why I have not seen yet any real disruption. And when we started this show, it was all about how will the transportation sector be disrupted by the infusion of software? And so far, to be honest, I don't think we've gotten an answer that suggests that there will be a disruption and that it will actually be sustained by an infusion of software. And this means, so let's look at the entrance. That's usually the way you see disruption. It's how we follow the entrance stories. And if you look at Tesla, and that was an entrant that we hoped for would be disruptive, we couldn't find a way to convince ourselves that it is. Secondly, that's not, again, to say it's going to fail. It's just not going to make
sustaining. It's just part of the club. Yeah, they joined the club. Yeah.
Automaker go out of business. It's not going to happen, right? Nor did, in the sense that Toyota didn't disrupt by, they did change the dynamics, but they did not cause displacement of incumbents. They caused them to sort of lose a little bit of market share. And same with Volkswagen. Same with Chevy when Ford was around. Chevy came in, took half the business, but Ford was still around. And that's the thing. Disruption in the auto industry does not mean displacement. Disruption in the auto industry must mean sustained market entry with sustained market share. That's what it has happened with all of the entrants, from Chevrolet against Ford, to Volkswagen against everyone, to Toyota against everyone, and now potentially through, also before, let's not forget, Korea versus everyone, and then China versus everyone, and now the entrants coming in from technology companies. So I think what's going to happen is Tesla is going to have a nice foothold market. I think Google, it will have to see what their strategy is and whether they license or build their own. Uber, we have to also see whether they actually get into bending metal. And Apple, which I think is going to be very much like a slightly tweaked Tesla logic, focused on design rather than on performance. And so they'll have a nice foothold market. I don't see Apple coming in and everybody driving an Apple car. Just like, you know, maybe as far as we got, remember when VW was wildly successful, let's say early 70s, it still only meant probably that they had like 15% market share,
right?
And then what you would witness is you'd go out on the street and you'd see bugs everywhere. You'd drive around in San Francisco, and I sometimes end up seeing a TV show from the 70s or something like that. And I'm always amused. I ignore all the action and dialogue. I just look at cars. And I just see all these Volkswagens.
All these bugs, right, in certain places.
And this was true not just in the U.S. It was true also in Europe, which is, again, a phenomenal success if you look at it that way. And also in emerging countries like, at the time, Latin America. So it's... That's what it means to win in the car business. So okay, back to the question. So what we're seeing then is the entry of electric drivetrains. The theory suggests that that's going to sustain. And as a result, we're seeing BMW saying, yes, please, more. I'll have more of that. Thank you. Will we see GM do that? Sure. Well, they've got the Chevy Volt out already. Then they're going to have more. Will they make some kind of, you know, watershed event where they say we'll switch over all our production to electric? That may take another 10, 15 years, but I think it'll happen. At that point, when GM does actually finally get in and throw in with it, or Toyota, who's actually bigger now, then we'll finally, you know, it'll be a fait accompli. It's a done deal. It's as if no one will be even raising an eyebrow when GM does it, because they'll have expected GM to do it for 5 years already. But by then, no one will second guess the notion that every car will be electric. But again, to switch over 2 billion cars will still take another decade. No, sorry, a couple of decades. Each car, remember, if each car lasts 10 years,
right,
what might accelerate it, and here's again where government comes into play. You know, we'll see buyback schemes. We'll see the state of California banning internal combustion wholesale. By the way, just one more anecdote on this. The Germans did similar things with photovoltaics.
Solar.
They try to make solar a bigger part of their energy consumption, because the Greens at the time, I think the Greens were in power, and they pushed forward these incentives in the form of paid-in tariffs.
Right.
And so as a result, actually, an industry emerged in Germany for making these solar panels, which they couldn't get enough of otherwise. So the German Q-Cells company was formed in the region south of Berlin, which was a depressed region
depressed
at the time.
From the east, yeah.
Yeah, and it was East Germany, and suddenly, not only because of government, you know, and this is when everybody patted themselves on the back and said, here we are, government and business hand in hand, we're creating innovation,
right,
we're getting industry off the ground, we're creating a market. And what happened is, though, and here's the, as those tariffs were sustained, and also Spain joined in and others, and the market was created for solar panels, and there was an actual demand for them that was higher, much higher than what the supply was, Chinese firms started to make solar panels, and they added so much production of solar panels that actually they swamped the market,
right,
and drove the prices so far down that there were, you know, anti-dumping regulations put in place. So in the sense that government went from we will pay above market rates for solar panels to how dare you charge below market rates for solar panels. And so what happened over a few years is that actually the market was created for new entrants in the solar market. And eventually, the market actually caused those solar panel makers to go out of business. And here we're seeing, and this may sound a little bit, I'm being a little bit controversial here, but if California, the home of Tesla, imposes a regulation that says every car has to be an electric car, what's the likely outcome? Every other car maker is going to, because they sell so many cars, is suddenly going to ramp up electric production just because they have to stay in the state. But as a result, electric car prices will collapse to the point where actually Tesla will no longer be tenable in its current business model. The most likely outcome, in other words, the most likely outcome I see of government getting involved in imposing and trying to accelerate the adoption of electric cars is that electric car pioneers will be put out of business. And think about that for a minute as we end the show.
Yes, exactly.
It's just this irony of creating a market, but without really thinking through the job, without really thinking through, because frankly, entrepreneurs, and you know, bless them, they have a hard job, and it's really hard to think about it, you know, in all of these dynamics. But one of the things that may happen is indeed that as the market really enters the 10% plus phase, and this is again an S curve, and then 10% is the threshold where things go straight up. At that moment in time, it will be very precarious for the early companies,
yes,
because they will not be geared towards production and therefore expanding volumes in the same way that either incumbents or latecomers, if it's a new market, super latecomers, like China.
Right.
So we may end up with a situation that actually you're going to be driving a Chinese electric car. And so not only will Detroit lose, but so will Tesla and the other guys.